history through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, brought to you by Paul Everett's RV Country, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are heroes around you. There are men and women who have stories to tell, and they won't call themselves that. They're too humble, and that's the case again today. But I think the rest of us, when we hear these stories, we're certainly struck by how much they love our country. We're going to meet quite a guy today. Each week we visit with members of our greatest generation. We want to honor our veterans for their service and sacrifice. We want to preserve their stories so we don't forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And along the way, we learn a lot. We're educated, we're entertained, really inspired. The gentleman you're going to meet today has been educating folks for a long time in Hawaii at the USS Arizona Memorial. He makes appearances every year around the holidays. And maybe you've been out there if you visited the USS Arizona Memorial and seen some of those incredible sights. Maybe you've met this gentleman and shook his hand and heard some of his stories from Pearl Harbor. We're going to hear about that. We're going to hear why he cut off his finger to get in the Navy. And we're going to hear a whole lot more. Who knows what we're going to hear from 95-year-old Delton Wally Walling of Valley Springs, California. Valley Springs isn't all that big of a place. It's a pretty drive out here on Highway 26. But how big was your hometown of Belding, Michigan?
4,500.
That's a big city.
Big city in those days.
And you grew up in a big family.
12 kids, 6 girls and 6 boys.
And you were the youngest of that dozen.
And I was the youngest. So they ran out of names when they came to me. And the old Dutch lady that spanked me on the butt and started me on my life ran out of names.
Uh-huh.
So Delton, you don't hear. You might hear Elton or something like that. Mm-hmm. But I've never heard of Delton in my life.
Mm-hmm. I know one other. Maybe I'll give him your number so you guys can huddle up together. Not that common of a name. And not too common to be the youngest of 12 kids growing up during the Great Depression. What was that like for you? What do you remember about those days?
Hard work. From the time I was 4 or 5 years old, I was working, doing something to keep the farm going.
4 and 5 years old.
Yep.
So is that like milking cows, pulling weeds? What are you doing?
Milking cows and cleaning up the barn.
Dirty jobs.
Dirty jobs. Didn't realize at that time or think anything about it because that was a common way of life.
Sure. And you lost your father at a very young age.
Very young. I was 7 years old about that time. He was a farmer and he was also an educated merchant marine man.
Mm-hmm.
He worked for President Lines, so he traveled the world. We knew nothing about the world because he done all the traveling. And, of course, we had 12 kids. Every time I come home, I guess we're going to have another kid.
That's how it worked. Good thing he was gone a little bit. Otherwise, there might have been 20.
Yeah, that's right.
What happened? How was he killed?
He was on a trip coming out of Hong Kong to go down to Manila, and he had a rupture in his intestines.
Mm.
And during his sleep, he went to bed, and he had a strangulation hernia, and it killed him.
Wow. So for you, as a 7-year-old kid, no chance to say goodbye, just this stunning news.
That's it.
How did you deal with that at such a young age?
Well, I really don't know. I can't go back to how I was thinking at 7 years mm-hmm. of age. My brothers all passed away early. They were unlucky and got diphtheria and smallpox. In those days, you didn't have vaccines.
Mm-hmm.
And they got it. So it killed 4 of them, so it left 2. My brother that was in the Philippines at the time that I was there, and me. He was my older brother right next to me.
Mm-hmm.
And so I grew up only knowing that brother. And my sisters, all 3 of the 6, got polio. So
wow.
They were all crippled.
Holy
sisters
smokes.
All their lives. But they made a wonderful life out of that by being able to set and do a job, like working for AT&T and bell telephone, stuff like that.
So you were dealing with tragedy from a very young age, and lo and behold, you would be witness to one of the most tragic days in American history that led, of course, to some of the greatest triumphs in American history, as we're going to touch on with your Pearl Harbor story. But still in your childhood, I know you got into boxing pretty early, and you were pretty good. Where did that come from?
Well, when my mother married again, and I went to live with them for a short period of time, it was in a country school, and a family of 12 boys out of one family ruled that little school.
I can imagine why.
And here I am, just a skinny little runt, and boy, they beat up on me all the time. So I was coming home, and my stepdad was seeing that, and he had been a policeman in the Grand Rapids Police Department, and he knew all the rough tactics. So one day, he called me Stubby. He said, Stubby, I'm going to teach you all the rough tactics of how to protect yourself. And when you go to school, when I get done with you, you better not come back without saying you took the biggest bully and put him down. And so 6 or 8 months later, he says, you're ready to go. You go to school today and you get that the meanest one there. And I want to see the results. I went to school and done just exactly what he said. That bully never bothered me again, and no one in that school, and from then on in life, has messed around with me too much, because I'll come loose.
And you got into competitive boxing. You even did the Golden Gloves.
Yeah. And then when I went in the Navy there at Pearl Harbor, I was boxing all the time at the Block Recreation Center there, and we fought every week, paid no attention to how many or what or who we fought.
Yeah,
it was just in the recreation. Then I went on out in the Pacific, and on my ship, I had a boxing group on my ship. Well, the record says 115 bouts and 198 or something like that. I don't even know how many I won.
And boxing works into your Navy story. And you mentioned your dad being in the Merchant Marines and sailing all over the world. Is that where your idea of getting in the Navy came from?
No. I could see the war is coming.
You read the newspapers, heard what Hitler was doing?
You see, before the war started, we didn't even know where Japan was. There was a map, a globe map, and here's an island, and this is Japan. We didn't know the people. We didn't know their culture. We knew nothing. Then I can see the Roosevelt has cut off their oil and gas and iron, and so they're backed up against the wall. They're going to go do something. They got to do something to keep themselves alive. And I could kind of read that in. So that's when I
graduated. You decided to join the Navy?
And that's when I joined, because I don't like to dig a foxhole and lay with the snakes and stuff like that.
So you figured a war is coming, and I'm going to get in the Navy where I've got a bed to sleep on and good food and all that. But it wasn't that simple for you to get in the Navy.
No, I had to cut the finger off.
I got to get that story. Our listeners aren't going to believe this, and I've never met anybody else and all the hundreds of veterans I've talked to that have a story of getting into the service quite like this. So you and your buddy hitchhiked to Detroit.
Detroit, 180 miles.
And you could do that then. People would pick you up.
Oh, yeah. We got down there to the recruiting station, and they took my buddy. They stuffed him full of five bananas and got him heavy enough, and they took him. But when they came to me, I had that stiff finger sticking down straight. The doctor walked over to me.
And this finger is sticking down. This is from boxing. So you had broken two of your fingers, and your middle finger on your right hand
is sticking down straight.
So you couldn't shake someone's hand. That finger would get in the way.
That's right. But it wasn't bothering me as far as I'm concerned.
You're getting used to it. But the doctor looks at it, and what does he tell you?
He walks over, and he grabs hold of my hand, and he takes that finger and tries to bend it. And he put me right down on the deck.
It hurt that much.
That hurt bad. He said, you're 4F, go home. And I told him, wait a minute. I can lick the whole bunch of you guys at one time with my arm behind my back. What do I have to do to get in this great Navy? And he says, cut it off.
Cut it off.
I said, your expense or mine? He says, yours.
What were you thinking? Just like that, cut it off. You really didn't care.
I didn't care. I had to get in the Navy.
Wow.
So
he says, you have to cut it off and you have to pay for it.
I have to pay for it. So I had to make out a form because I don't want to cut this thing off and I can't get in the Navy. So he made it out And I went down on the streets of Detroit and finally found a shingle up there that said surgeon. And I went in, and that old doctor was older than I am now.
And you're 95.
And I am 95. And he looked at me and he said, "You're nuts." And I said, "I know that, but I got to get in the Navy." So after a little haggling, finally he said, "Oh, I'll cut it off." And I said, "No, wait a minute. I only got $20 and I got 180 miles to hitchhike home. Can you leave me enough for a sandwich?" He thought a minute and he said, "Well, maybe." He cut it off and left me $3. So I'm in the Navy. I went home for 9 or 10 days and then reported right in the Great Lakes.
Mm-hmm.
When I reported in the Great Lakes, because my dad had been in the Merchant Marine, somehow I got acquainted with Morse code. Mm-hmm. And it kind of fascinated me.
Mm-hmm.
So I started studying that on my own. It paid off because when I got into Great Lakes, the chief was checking your records and stuff and found out that I knew the code. Mm-hmm. And we was very short in those days on communication people.
Right.
He said, "Let's go out. I want to see what you know." He made me an instructor. So I didn't have to march and all that stuff. I was an instructor in Morse code.
Mm-hmm.
And then when I graduated and reported to the Pennsylvania in Bremerton, Washington, as I walked aboard, the chief signalman on the Pennsylvania, he was there 30 years, and he was a tough old cookie.
Mm-hmm.
And I had no discipline whatsoever. Didn't even know what it was.
Uh-oh.
So he had made a deal with Admiral Richardson that he could take anyone off in the street and teach them more about communications than they could learn at sea. Richardson had nothing to lose because we don't have them. So he had nothing to lose. He made the deal with him. And as I started up the gangway, coming on, he's standing there, that old gravel voice, and he says, "Sailor, step out." And I thought, my God, I haven't even got aboard, and I've already done something.
You're in trouble.
I'm in trouble. So he picked out 15 more, and the next day we found out what discipline was. Because if he gave you something to learn today, you better have it tomorrow, because he's going to be right, the admiral.
Sure. So this is a big battleship, the Pennsylvania.
Pennsylvania is the flagship of the Pacific Fleet. And Richardson is the admiral at that time. I was only with him a short period of time.
And your job is going to be communications.
Communications.
So you do that through Morse code, through flags?
Flags.
Uh-huh. Semaphore.
See, all until the Marianas Turkey Shoot in the Pacific. All your maneuvering of the ships was done by flag.
Mm-hmm.
We couldn't go to radio because the Japanese would know where we're at.
Right.
And we're undermanned.
Mm-hmm.
We cannot be in the same waters with the Japanese. Because at the start of the war, we only had 3 carriers. They had 10. They had 100, over 100 destroyers. Mm-hmm. And we had 50. And so on down through the fleet. So we didn't belong in the same waters with the Japanese. And Richardson knew that. Now, Roosevelt comes aboard, and he wants Richardson to take the fleet to Pearl Harbor. Richardson had, in 1936, when he was a rear admiral, he had pulled a mock attack on Pearl Harbor, and he knew it could be done with his little squadron.
Mm-hmm.
And immediately he told Roosevelt, "I'm not taking the fleet to Pearl Harbor. I'm not going to put it in harm's way."
Wow.
Out he went. You have not heard of Admiral Richardson. There's been nothing said in the books or nothing about that great admiral.
But you were there with him.
And I was there with him.
And are you saying the president came aboard your ship to talk to him?
Yep.
You were
right
there.
I was there.
And here comes FDR.
Yep.
This is in 1940.
That's, or yeah, 40. So he threw out. Now they got to pick a new admiral.
Right.
Admiral Kimmel was a very brilliant man. Him and Nimitz was next in the line to take it.
Mm-hmm.
Nimitz was on a special assignment in Washington, and he should have been your new admiral. But because he was on that special assignment, he was given to Kimmel. Now, Kimmel told Roosevelt the very same thing that Richardson did. "I don't want to put the fleet in harm's way, but I also don't want to lose my ranks."
Mm-hmm.
"So I will take the fleet and do the best I can to get it ready." And he did just that. He was a very efficient, tough admiral.
And you were around him.
and I was around him, and I was a tough little at that time. And when we went into his force, he had a little talk with us, and he said, I don't like tattoos. If anyone gets a tattoo, they're gone. Well, you're telling me something I don't like. So about 6 months later, five of us are out of the gang. He can't fire all of us. We decided to go ashore and get tattoos.
Right.
We drew straws, and I become the first one to get the tattoo on my chest. Two little birds. And when I crawled off from that table, all my buddies are gone. I'm the only one going back with a tattoo.
They suckered you, huh?
Suckered me. A couple of days later, he's not supposed to be aboard.
It's so you're sneaking back on the ship, and the admiral's not supposed to be there.
Yeah, I just come back off, but I'm staying hid, see, I think. But this is Sunday, and he's not aboard. And so I'm out on the gun shield, in behind the gun shield, laid out there on the deck.
Working on your tan.
Sunning the scabs, you know.
Oh, trying to get that tattoo to heal up a little.
Yeah. And all at once, I got a kick in the butt. And I looked up, and there stands the old man.
Uh-oh.
Stand up, sailor. I stood up. He said, so, you think you're going to get away from me because you got the tattoo, do you? And I said, sir, I never thought about it, but I had thought about it. And he stood there and looked at me a minute, and he said, I got news for you. You're going to be with me as long as I'm an admiral in this Navy. And some days are not going to be as good as others. And he was exactly right. And we got along wonderful after that. I become his personal signalman when we was traveling to different ships to inspect it. I traveled with him. And then when Nimitz took over later, I stayed right doing the same job. I traveled with Nimitz everywhere he went.
So you got a real interesting perspective on the big picture of the war, and you had an interesting physical perspective of what happened December 7th, because you had a bird's eye view that very few people had. But I'm interested, before we get into that Sunday morning, did you have any sense, while you're on Oahu, did you have any sense that war was that imminent, that something was about to happen?
The smaller service band, nothing leaked down to them very much. You might pick up something like... a month before, when Roosevelt got a hold of Short and Kimmel and said, set up installations, gunneries and stuff, but don't put it out in sight where the civilians can see it. How can you do that in Pearl Harbor? They're looking down right on you. So they did that.
It's time for our first break, but when we come back, we'll hear about that fateful Sunday morning at Pearl Harbor and the unique way that Wally Walling experienced it. You also might not believe who taught him how to surf. Plenty of photos up for you at hometownheroesradio.com and the Hometown Heroes page on Facebook. And we'll be right back after this. If you'd like to sell your low-mileage, well-maintained RV in excellent condition, bring it to Paul Everett's RV Country and they'll sell it for you. That's right. Consignments are welcome. Any type of motorhome, travel trailer, or fifth wheel. With 8 locations in 5 states, there's probably a Paul Everett's within driving distance of this radio station. Helping RVers get the most out of their RVs is another one of those things that make doing business with Paul such a unique pleasure. Paul Everett's RV Country in Fresno and Indio, California, Bullhead City, Arizona, Laughlin, Nevada, Coburg, Oregon, and 3 locations in Washington, Fife, Milton, and Mount Vernon. For the exact locations, go to the website. That address is rvcountry.com. That's rvcountry.com. Over 55 years of experience and 1 million RVers served. Paul Everett's RV Country, proud supporters of Hometown Heroes.
Proudly presented by Paul Everett's RV Country. This is Hometown Heroes, celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and our colorful conversation with 95-year-old Delton Wally Walling of Valley Springs, California, originally from Belding, Michigan, a small town on the Flat River east of Grand Rapids. He wanted to join the Navy bad enough before World War II that he gave up a finger. If you missed that explanation at the start of the program, you can always pull up the podcast at hometownheroesradio.com, where you'll also see photographic evidence of that missing digit. Let's take him back to late 1941 now. He's a teenage sailor assigned to the battleship USS Pennsylvania at Pearl Harbor. What was life like before that attack?
Beautiful days.
Yeah.
No, nothing to worry about. Not a thing.
It's a big adventure for you.
Big adventure.
Here's this kid from Michigan, and he's out there in the Pacific with all the pretty ladies and Waikiki Beach. Did you surf at all?
Duke Onamoko, you're a great surfer of the Pacific.
Yeah.
See, I lived in Hawaii just a little bit of time before. And Duke taught me how to surf on this big old wooden board that was 18 inches wide and 14 feet long.
A longboard, yeah.
I couldn't even carry it. He dragged it out there for me.
He personally taught you how to surf.
Yeah, but I was never any good because I didn't have time, really didn't have time. But I knew Duke very well. And when I go to out there to Hawaii and go out to the beach, I always go into Duke's and sit and chat a while.
I don't think I've ever talked to someone who learned how to surf from Duke himself.
Yeah, the last time I was down, nothing doing before we went back. They had to take me over and stand me in front of the board and take all the pictures.
That's great. That's great.
Last time down.
Next time I see that statue, I'm going to think of you. So you're doing all these things, having all these adventures. It's a great life in the Navy. But December 7th, 1941, that all changed. And you were up early that day, huh?
Because I was a boxer and staying in shape. I always run 20 miles a day. I was out on my run. And then I remembered that I had a friend that was being transferred from the gang. He owed me some money, quite a bit.
Uh-oh.
So at 6:30, I arrived at the tower and thought I'd go up and talk to him and see if I could get some money.
And explain to us what this tower is and what it was used for.
The communication tower at Pearl Harbor that I was on was a water tank with a signal platform on the top.
Right
out in the open, right in all the weather. Just a little shack set 6 foot square right in the middle. And that tower berthed every ship that ever came into Pearl Harbor for 125 years.
In fact, you were just there this last year for the renovation and the dedication of the rebuilt tower. It's still there.
It's still there.
Yeah.
And I sent it on its next 100 years. Cut the ribbon and set it on its next 100 years in May.
Mm-hmm. But so at that point, this is one of the places where you have to have a shift. You're up there in the tower handling communications?
Yes, because you can see every ship in the harbor from that 180-foot advantage. That's why when we came into port with the Pennsylvania, then we went ashore to our quarters on shore, and Kimmel went over to his quarters at Makalapa, which has always been the same.
Mm-hmm.
Even today, it's the same. He goes over there. We go to the receiving station or houses. The senior signalman, the first class, and the chiefs got houses. But the rest of us all stay at the receiving station.
So this was not your shift. You're out for a run, but you remember, hey, the guy who is on shift is about to ship out. And if I don't go get my money from him now, I'm never going to get it.
That is correct.
So you go up in that tower, 6:30 in the morning.
When I get up there in the tower, the ward is a destroyer that's guarding the entrance to Pearl Harbor. And that morning we had the Antares, that's a transport, coming back from Palmar Island with a tug tow on behind, a barge tow on behind. And they had stopped out at the entrance to shift the barge over to another tug to take it in the port. And when they went to stop, somebody spotted some strange object in between the tow line and the barge. But before this, at 3 o'clock in the morning, someplace between Pearl Harbor and Honolulu, the midget subs was dropped off in the big subs, someplace in between. Mm-hmm. And so they was maneuvering to go in. This is their idea, to follow ships in.
So these Japanese submarines are all over the place in there.
Well, there's five came in.
Right.
Well, five didn't get in, but some of them did.
But you don't know this while you're up in that tower.
We have nothing. Mm-hmm. We don't know yet. And then all at once, the ward spots this con or something. And so this lieutenant that's on the ward, this is his first day in command of the ward.
Mm-hmm.
And this is a mighty decision that he's going to have to make, because you don't know, is that friendly or is it an enemy?
And you don't want to be the boy who's crying wolf.
Yeah. Uh-huh. And overhead, there's a PBY-2A2. And they don't want to drop anything on it because they don't know.
Right.
So neither one of them is doing anything. Mm-hmm. But this lieutenant said, full steam ahead, and they went around. And when they come around, they was only 150 yards from that sub. Mm-hmm. And all they could see was a con. He just threw caution to the wind and said, fire. Now, number one gun couldn't get low enough and overshot. Number three gun could get low enough, and he hit it. There he is.
You've got a photo with him right there. You guys right met there. At Pearl Harbor?
Yeah.
So that's happening before the planes come in?
That's before the planes come in. That's at 6:30.
And are you aware of that up in this tower? Is that message coming to you?
Well, now this has all started. So the ward now, they say sighted sub in restricted area and sunk same. Now, the protocol at that time, you broke it all down in code instead of just sending the message to us.
Right.
And we could talk right to the admiral. It went by code, broke down. Now, this takes time. This is 6:30. Mm-hmm. So this 6:30, they break it down, and it goes around to the headquarters. Kimmel gets out his staff, and they got to study it. Now, they got to verify it. Break it down again, round as it went, and back to the ward. The ward can't say anything, but the same thing. It sunk. Mm-hmm. How can they verify it? So, the same thing goes back, you see. Now, it's 7:56, and we're standing there, and it's a beautiful day. And all at once, overhead, we've got planes, high planes, low planes, all coming in on us. Oh, must be a big maneuver today. Those orange balls up there is not ringing the bell yet. Mm-hmm. It's not ringing the bell, even when we see those black objects dropping out of those planes.
It hasn't hit you yet that this is enemy.
That isn't it. Mm-hmm. And when the bomb went off on Fort Allen, and all planes are exploding everywhere, we know we're in war.
And you saw that, clear as day.
I watch it all. I'm the only one that can tell you the Pearl Harbor story, and this is the reason why. I'm looking down on everything. You're on a ship, mm-hmm. and that ship gets hit by a torpedo or what? Who sees that? The ship itself. That's all. They can't see beyond it. Mm-hmm. But I'm looking down on everything. But remember this, you can't see it all at one time because everything's blowing up at one time.
Right.
So you can't even follow it. Mm-hmm. All you can just pick up in pieces. See?
Well, and that's what, you know, on this program over the years, I've heard from guys who are on a lot of different ships or on land while this is happening, and they have those little slivers of the puzzle that they saw from their perspective. And your perspective is intriguing, and what you're saying is you're the last guy left that was in that tower and looking from that spot where you could see each one of these things that's happening. You're, what, 19, 20 years old?
19.
What in the world was going through your head?
I'm froze to the rail because the first thing that happened just before the plane started dropping was Hickam Field is blowing up. It's right behind me. I'm looking, oh, maybe a couple minutes or something before the raid started right over Pearl Harbor. Mm-hmm. So Hickam Field is destroyed immediately. Now I'm froze to that rail because I have joined the greatest navy of all times. And here it is, being blown up in my face in a few minutes. Mm-hmm. I'm devastated because if they can do that in 10 minutes, what else is coming?
Right.
And scuttlebutt is everywhere. They've already landed on the other side and, oh man, you don't know what to believe.
I'm sure there's all kinds of stuff, and I want to hear about that, but I hope I didn't cut you off in describing what you saw there in the order you saw it. So you saw those explosions on Fort Island.
See, the Arizona never blew up till 8:06. It's the last ship that blew up because your California sunk, Oklahoma's rolled over, the Utah's rolled over, mm-hmm. and the West Virginia's got hit by at least 7 torpedoes. It's a mess. It went straight down.
And you're seeing each one of these?
I'm seeing it after the fact. Mm-hmm. You cannot possibly see it because you're looking there, a bomb went off, one's already gone there. You're looking and seeing after the fact.
Yeah, you can't keep your eye on everything at the same time.
There's no way. Mm-hmm. Then the Curtis was an aircraft tender. Curtis and the Tangier. The Tangier was anchored over there by the Utah. That Utah berth was a carrier berth. That's where the carriers berthed. So that's why those tenders was over there anchored out there in the channel.
Mm-hmm.
Because they was helping out with repairs and everything. And so they was just waiting for the carriers to come in. And here comes a dive bomber in, and he's diving on the Curtis, and just all at once, man, he burst into flames and went straight on into the Curtis. That plane was the only plane that hit a ship itself during the raid. That was the plane that hit the Curtis.
And you saw it.
And I saw it.
So you're seeing explosion, fire.
Fire.
And some of the photos that people have seen since, one of the ones that I think turns the most heads is the USS Shaw.
You're exactly right. The Shaw being on dry dock,
right,
up in the air.
Mm-hmm.
Now, when it was hit and the magazine blew it apart, now that concussion, because they're in the air, just comes high. So we did feel the concussion from where we were at on the tower from the Shaw.
Mm-hmm.
But the Arizona, because it was in the water, and the bomb, see, I'm in that film also called Countdown to Disaster,
mm-hmm,
when the Arizona blew up.
Right.
Now, before the war come along, you had your old box cameras. Now, there was a doctor that lived over on Ford Island right there by the Arizona.
Mm-hmm.
He happened to be out there that morning taking pictures of the Arizona, and he took the pictures as it exploded. But that camera was never found for about 70 years.
Isn't that crazy?
And they found it. Now they're able to enhance it, stop things. So that is why the film is called Countdown to Disaster. Because they start the story at 7:56. That's when the war started with the first bomb.
Mm-hmm.
And they bring it through. They tell stories and they bring it through a few or a minute or two, and then they carry it on through. And then here comes the bomb, and they stop it right off in the number one turret, where it's going to glance off and go into the magazine.
Mm-hmm.
And they stop it, and they say, 1 second before disaster. And then, boom, she blows.
All those images that we've seen, you're seeing all of this unfold from this bird's eye view on this tower. At what point do you realize that there's something you can do? Because I imagine for most of that, you just felt really helpless.
We can't do anything.
Mm-hmm.
There's no way of us doing a thing. All the damage is done. All we can do is try to get the men out of the water. And we have nothing up there. This is not our battle station down below. Our battle station is on the tower. Just as soon as the war started, then all the men that belonged to Kimmel came down. There's a building being built right under the tower. And that's where they took the protection and stayed there in case somebody shot us off in the tower.
Mm.
And so I was there until two shifts. I was there all day and through my shift.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, that evening, see, your Enterprise planes started to come in, and they started to come up the channel. Six of them had been out looking for the Japanese fleet. In the southern section, the Japanese are in the north. So they never found them.
But
so
if those carriers had been in the harbor, the war would have been over.
That's right.
Yeah.
That was a mistake. The only reason they weren't there is because they had to slow down in oil.
Mm-hmm.
So that would make them about 10 hours late.
Thank
just,
the Lord.
Just the luck. Ooh. See, just luck.
So there, the planes from the carrier USS Enterprise are coming in.
Six of them.
Uh-huh.
Now, they don't know that the ramp and everything's all shot up. There's no way of them landing on it. They're coming in after dark. They don't know.
Mm-hmm.
And when they started to come up the channel, the loudspeakers come out and said, don't shoot at these planes. They're friendly. I've been in war long enough to know that if one man, one ship, touches off a shell, they're all going to go.
Right.
And so he's coming up the channel, and all at once somebody fires. Boom. Knocked down the first three planes, and only one flyer was saved. I didn't know that, of course. It's dark. I didn't know that until the next day. The other three veered off and went over on one of the Army bases over Schofield. And they started to land over there, and they were shot down. One flyer survived. So two of the six plane flyers survived.
Tragic.
Now, here's another thing that was so much luck. Everybody says, well, what was our planes doing? Why was they doing this and that? That was a lucky situation, because if those flyers had been in their planes and got in the air, they'd all been lost.
Good point.
See? Now your planes can be shipped to you. You got your flyers to protect the islands. See? Mm-hmm. We wouldn't have had a flyer. All 70-some of them would have been dead.
There are so many of those examples throughout the war, every part of the war. What if this or that had been a little bit different? How different would the eventual outcome have been? We are far from done with 95-year-old Delton Wally Walling. If you want to see the tower he was in on December 7th and find other photos that add to his story, visit the Hometown Heroes Facebook page. And we'll explore more of what he witnessed from that tower when Hometown Heroes comes right back after this. Remember when the bank gave you free checking and savings accounts, even making money for you when you kept your dollars there? Paul Leffler here to say, I've recaptured those days, and you can too with EECU. It's not a bank, it's a nonprofit credit union that just keeps growing and growing. The newest branch is in Tulare, and nearly a quarter million EECU members represent 10 different California counties. As little as $250 in a savings account earns you dividends. And access is so easy. 30,000 ATMs, free mobile banking. And I haven't even told you what I love most about EECU, the credit union's support of causes up and down our area, like Central Valley Honor Flight. More than 500 World War II veterans have gotten to see their memorial in Washington, D.C. for free because of the leadership and financial support of EECU. Ready to join the team yet? Call 1-800-538-3328. Paul Everett's RV Country has 8 locations in 5 western states, including Fresno and Indio, California, Bullhead City, Arizona, Laughlin, Nevada, Coburg, Oregon, right off the I-5, and 3 locations in Washington, Fife, Milton, and Mount Vernon. Over 55 years of experience serving the needs of RVers across the country and proud supporters of Hometown Heroes. Find a location near you by visiting rvcountry.com.
Honoring veterans from sea to shining sea. You're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler, brought to you by this local station and its sponsors, and presented everywhere on the air and online by Paul Everett's RV Country, with 8 locations in 5 western states.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and our fascinating visit with a pretty fascinating man, 95-year-old Pearl Harbor survivor Delton Wally Walling, a man of many talents. For example, he just reeled in a 75-pound octopus off the Northern California coast a few weeks ago. And he's also a man who carries haunting memories of December 7th, 1941, not to mention the rest of the war. For 14 hours before, during, and after the Japanese attack, he was in a 180-foot observation tower witnessing on a broad scale the devastation of that day, which has indeed lived in infamy. Wally has taken us on quite a journey so far, but I want to make sure that we don't miss out on some of those things that really only he can describe for us.
What are some of the things you saw from that tower that most people have never seen? I mean, besides the battleships exploding, you're seeing aerial combat too? You're seeing planes getting shot down?
I never ever saw a Japanese plane shot down. I saw some smoking, but I could not follow out. Did they crash it or what? But I saw them smoking.
And how close did they fly to your tower?
150 feet.
That's pretty close.
Right there. I'm looking right at them. Uh-huh. When they got the canopy shoved back when they're sinking the California, and they're coming right through about 50 feet right down there, right? You can look right into their plane because they got such a short distance to get over the Helena and get that torpedo in to hit the California. See, that's just a short distance across there. And so they've got to get low in over the buildings there, workshops, and drop their torpedo right beyond Helena to get into the California. So we're looking, but they're looking straight ahead. They're not looking at nothing. mm-hmm. because they got to concentrate on that little short distance that they got.
And if you guys had had guns where you were, you could have shot them down.
Yeah.
But you're just sitting there observing, watching the show.
Yeah. In my time in the Navy, I never had a gun on my hip, even on the ship.
But they're flying past you. They could have shot your tower. They could have shot you guys.
Had they known that that was the Admiral's communication tower, I wouldn't be sitting here today.
Good thing they didn't know. But you guys did have some rounds come pretty close to your tower from your own ships, right?
Yeah, the Helena right there.
Uh-huh. You were just talking about the Helena. So the Helena's trying to shoot the planes down, and they almost shoot you guys in the tower.
Yeah.
How close do you think those rounds came?
Well, if it wasn't for that stack there, they'd have probably hit the tower.
Mm-hmm.
Same line right up across there. You could hear the bullets going by the tower.
Uh-huh. And I know we're bouncing around, but just here recently, you met a gentleman who lives less than an hour away from you, who was on the Helena and was one of those guys firing those shots.
Right.
So yeah. What'd you tell him?
Well, they just notified the ship that you might shoot us off if you keep it up.
Uh-huh.
So change your line of fire. But shortly afterwards, they got hit with the torpedoes and was taken away anyway.
Yeah, so much damage. And one of the other jobs that you had there in the tower, as I understand it, was trying to spot bodies in the harbor?
No, every morning.
The next days that followed?
Every morning there'd be bodies come up. And we're the only one that can see the whole water area. Mm-hmm. And so we would notify the barges that are picking up the people. And they would go, they just put a line on them and drag them to the landing, and then it was taken out on the stretchers and taken away.
So you're up there with binoculars or something, scanning
the
harbor?
We got the big scopes.
Yeah.
We can see everything.
What a morbid job.
Well, somebody had to do it. I mean, it was just something that come along. It was just, you never thought anything about it.
And I guess that's one of my questions, since so few people ever saw what you saw from that vantage point. And you talked about some of the different explosions, but the aftermath. Once all the planes were gone, and you don't know, like you say, if there's a land invasion coming, that rumor's out there. There's all kinds of things, I'm sure, that are going through your mind. But after the Japanese forces are gone and you're looking at what's left, can you describe that scene for us?
When I'm looking at that's left, immediately what goes in through your mind? Are we going to be able to defeat the Japanese? Because now we've seen how strong they are. Mm-hmm. Just a portion of what they got in the Pacific. See, they haven't even got their Asiatic fleet here.
When you're up there in that tower, that morning of December 7th, the planes are gone, the Arizona's still smoldering, the Utah and the Oklahoma are upside down, there's oil throughout the harbor, there's carnage. What was the thing that you saw that still sticks with you when you picture that scene in your mind? What do you see?
That scene of all that oil in the water, the men that was blew off into the water, and trying to swim out.
You could see him struggling in the water.
Oh, sure. Just a few hundred yards away. It was a terrible scene. You couldn't hardly watch it.
Do you think that could have been me?
You're damn right. It could have been me.
Do you wonder, are those some of my buddies out there?
Certainly. And there was. Mm. See, 32 was lost off the Pennsylvania.
Right, so your ship.
Uncle Herbie. Look what Uncle Herbie had. Yeah. Look what happened to him there.
Uncle Herbie is Herb Weatherwax, who's been interviewed on this program before. I met him out there at the Arizona Memorial. And he's going to be with you there this December 7th for the 75th anniversary. He's got you beat. You're only 95 and he's 99, huh? And he was on the Pennsylvania that morning?
He was on the Pennsylvania.
So you guys were part of that crew together, but you weren't on the ship because you're up in the tower.
See, on a big ship like that, you don't even know the people in the next division.
But so your ship's in dry dock, but it got hit. And 32 from the Pennsylvania were killed.
Right.
And you knew some of those guys?
Well, certainly.
How often do you think about that?
You never forget it. You never. You see, after World War II, I was 80% disabled. I was out there 5 years and 2 months without coming home.
5 years and 2 months, never a trip home.
Now, you can carry on with your job and your life, but there is no way that you can't stop the nightmares. What comes on us at night, you can't get rid of. There's no way.
And I know sometimes talking about it makes it even more painful, so I respect that, and I don't expect you to share anything that you don't feel you can. But what are those things that come back to you? What are the nightmares?
The tragedy the explosions, stuff like that will pop up, see. Mm-hmm.
So 3 weeks, mm-hmm. you're up there in that tower trying to find stuff that's
every day,
popping to the surface.
First thing in the morning when it got daylight, then we'd look the harbor over.
So across the country, this had quite an effect. This got people's attention. People were inspired to do something. Guys were signing up all over the place. But what did you see on Oahu in the wake of that attack as far as morale, resolve, determination? Did guys just want to go over and destroy the Japanese? How can you describe that atmosphere?
Well, everybody, after the raid was over, everybody wants to go after the Japanese. We don't know how we're going to do it.
Right.
But everybody wants to get on their back.
Mm-hmm.
And the morale right afterwards is bad because we don't have any equipment. We don't have nothing. How are we going to do it?
Mm-hmm.
We didn't know how inspired the people were of the United States to get in and everybody get in the act and get this problem solved and done.
And you mean everybody.
And I mean everybody.
Men, women, and children.
Yep.
And something you mentioned earlier, you said, you know, rumors of landings being made, a land invasion. Is that something that persisted for a few days or weeks that people were still concerned?
The next day, nothing has happened, so we know. And then we start to put it all together. We know the Japanese are gone because you can't find them.
Mm-hmm.
See, they're gone. Now, you see, before the war, why Kimmel could not find or see the Japanese before the raid.
Right.
Before the raid on Pearl Harbor, many months before that, Kimmel was supposed to get 80-some planes to look all the way around the islands, keep planes out there, up to 400 miles.
Wow.
And he kept asking for the planes. He ended up, he never had, 48 planes is the most he had. And of them 48 planes, only 3 or 4 of them could fly. We had no planes to go out there and look all the way around.
Mm-hmm.
But in the court-martial, that's brought up there in the court-martial, they tried to court-martial me because he didn't use surveillance
right
out there 400 miles. He didn't have it.
It wasn't his fault. Are there some things, and again, you go to Pearl Harbor every year, and you sit there and you talk to people who are visiting and you give them a firsthand perspective on what happened that day. Are there some things that you saw or became aware of that day and the days that followed that were, because we hear all about the tragedy and the devastation. Are there some things you heard about that told you, here's a silver lining or here's an act of heroism within this or here's something that lives were saved? Evidence of things could have been a whole lot worse if this and this and this didn't happen.
Well, I've told you a little about our pilots, and if they had been there, they'd have been destroyed.
Right.
So we saved all of them.
Sure.
So we got a jump start there.
What about, for instance, one of the gentlemen that I've interviewed, he's passed since, but he was on the Oklahoma, and he was one of those guys who was trapped inside the hull of the Oklahoma and then was freed when they finally welded through it and
got him out.
Is that something that you guys heard about at the time?
Oh, no, we could watch down. We was looking right down maybe 400 yards, looking right down on the Oklahoma when they were working on it.
So you see these guys.
We saw them, but we don't know what they're doing, you know.
You have no idea there's guys trapped inside. They're still
alive.
Oh, yeah,
we know they're in there. We can figure that out because they're trying to cut holes in there.
Yeah.
See? So we can see all that, but we're not right down there with them. We really don't know how they're doing it or what, but we know that they're doing it. See,
I would imagine from an emotional perspective, when you find out about something like that, when there's been so much tragedy and now you find out, hey, some guys who probably should have been dead are actually alive, that is some kind of encouragement or boost to your sales?
Oh, certainly. When they finally cut it open, you know, to get the guys out of the air tank, then a tank down in there that they had been down in there cleaning. It really hit hard when they found that there was 20-some in one compartment down there that they didn't get to, you know, and they died. And as they succumbed, they wrote on the wall in the darkness, you know, the messages on the wall to their loved ones and stuff. I never ever saw that, but I heard of it. You know, it's bad.
And I want to hear about what you did the rest of the war because, I mean, this is one day that changed the world. but you were involved in the response and a whole lot of things the rest of the war, and I want to talk about that. But while we're on the subject of Pearl Harbor, you are going to be there for the 75th anniversary.
Right.
And every year we wonder how many survivors are going to be there next year.
Well, do you see, 3 years ago, we thought that we could only have about 25 or 30 that ever show up. But some airlines or somebody in the United States brought over 200.
Mm-hmm.
And we had a big dinner at the Hilton. And I made a speech there. It was a great event. That's when we stopped the Pearl Harbor Association.
Right.
That was the end of it.
Yeah. Well, and many people look at this 75th anniversary and say,
it's a loss.
This will be the last deal.
It'll be the last. And so I'm just doing the best I can to hold together to make this last trip.
And what do you do when you go there?
There's my desk.
You set up a desk at the Arizona Memorial Visitor Center.
They have it all set up for me.
Yep.
The other boys come over Mondays, Wednesdays, and Fridays, only about 3 hours. That's all you can stand at our age.
Mm-hmm.
Because you got 100 people waiting to come through, and you can't write anymore.
So they want autographs.
They want
autographs. They want to talk to you.
Yeah. But we cannot talk to them. We all just give them a bio, the story.
Yeah.
That's the best way you can do, because you can't hold up that line.
There's always a line of people that want to talk to you.
What I give them is a short story on me and the damage that was done at Pearl Harbor. That's what I give them.
You have done that. You've taken photos and signed autographs and shaken the hands of thousands and thousands of people there.
Thousands.
Why do you do that? Why is that important to you?
I want the story told. I want the true story told.
Well, I'm thankful you've been sharing that with us today the way that only you can, and I don't think I'm the only one that wants to hear some more. So we're going to continue this on our next episode. We focused mainly on the first day of the war for America, but Wally was in the Pacific for the rest of the war, too. And we're going to hear some of those adventures and close calls next time. In the meantime, I'd love for you to pull up hometownheroesradio.com and click on the link that I have for you there to Friends and Neighbors magazine and a great article about Wally by Chase Anderson, who has done tremendous work documenting veteran stories in California's gold country. Chase has introduced Wally to another Pearl Harbor survivor in the area. They'll both be there on Oahu for the 75th anniversary on December 7th, Lord willing, and I hope you'll be here next time to hear the rest of this indefatigable 95-year-old story. Thanks so much for listening today. I'm Paul Leffler, reminding you again that freedom is not free.